political and policy changes that the department is recommending. This is House File 657. So I don't know who's going to kick off the parade today, but members, I just wanted to take one moment before we start. I don't know if certainly I know all of the members have been informed by email. I don't know, maybe perhaps some of the people in the audience. This morning, Peter Meslow died, son of Representative Meslow, who had been ill and had been fighting bone cancer for the last about a year and a half. So our condolences to Representative Meslow and his family on the very untimely death of his son, who was 19. So with that, let's proceed then with the presentation on the technical bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Jack Manson with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And I just want to do a kind of a brief intro into the department's tax bill, and then the presenters will come up kind of article by article. But one thing I'd like to draw your attention to is we've kind of made a processing change this year. And historically, the department's always had one technical bill and one policy bill. And what we've done is combine those provisions into one bill this year. So this bill will contain all of our technical proposals and then our other minor kind of policy proposals. The more substantive major proposals are in the governor's bill. And we did that for a couple different reasons. For one thing, it's easier to draft when you've got one section that has both a technical and a policy provision. This can all be incorporated into one section in this bill. I think it also kind of focuses the discussion more on what is the change, what is the substance of the change, rather than whether it's a technical or a policy change, and we've kind of got caught up in some of those discussions in the past years. Obviously, only one summary is needed rather than two bill summaries. This also makes it easier for staff, too, when we're putting together on this tax bill. If these things are in one section and one summary, that's helpful. And then I think years past, sometimes the technical bill would pass on its own, pass to the floor, and be signed into law. But for this, in recent history, that hasn't really happened. Our technical bill, as well as our policy bill, was always laid over for inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So those are some of the reasons that now we've come forward with a more of a combined bill. So before you use the department tax bill, you should have, hopefully in your packets, our revenue analysis, and then attached to that would be the bill summary. So there are some minor revenue implications in here, as you can see, and as the attorneys or presenters go through the bill, they'll direct you to those that have revenue impacts. And we also have Dick Gebhardt, our research director here, for any questions on the revenue impacts as we go through the discussion on the bill.
Mr. Manson, just excuse me one moment. Members, we're just going to have the department go through the bill today. We're not going to take any motions or any suggested action on the legislation today. So make note of that. If you do have or want to prepare any amendments or any motions to the bill, we'll do that at a later date. So just today, as I said, overview of the legislation and questions of the department.
Then, Mr. Chairman, there's six articles in the bill, and Article 1 is individual and corporate income tax, corporate franchise tax article, and our attorney from our Appeals and Legal Services Division, John Haugen, will present that article. There's a property tax article that will be presented by Lance DeRica and Harriet Sims, also attorneys with the department. So you have a sales and use tax article presented by Greg Heck, an attorney with the department. A lot of these names are familiar to you that have been on the committee for a few years. Special taxes will be presented by Pat Finnegan. And we have an Article 5 electronic payments article. Rick Walzer will present both that article and the miscellaneous provisions article. So So if there, if you'd like, we could get started on Article 1, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Let's start.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Haugen from the Department of Revenue. As Jack said, I'll be going through the individual income tax, corporate income tax changes, and there are a couple provisions dealing with the Minnesota estate tax in this article. Sections 1 and 5 deal with how we give refunds to corporations that file a return claiming a refund or file an amended return claiming for a refund. Currently, we send them out a paper check. It takes us longer and it costs us money to send a paper check. But what Sections 1 and 5 do is it says that these corporations should give us a bank account number with their corporate return, and then if they have a refund coming, we'll electronically funds transfer their refund to them. Should make things cheaper for the department to process and also get the refund more quickly to the taxpayer. Section 2 deals with the Minnesota composite returns. Composite returns are where you have a flow-through entity like a partnership, S-corporation, or a trust, where they have non-resident owners. These non-resident owners, they can, if this flow-through entity has Minnesota source income, they have two optional ways of taking care of their Minnesota tax obligation. They can either file their own individual returns, or they can elect to be included on what is called a composite return that's filed by the entity. Currently, our composite return requirements say that we only allow composite return treatment for individual owners. So if you were a trust or a C corporation, you wouldn't be able to be included on the composite return. The first change we're making in this section is we're saying that trusts themselves, if they're an owner of an S corporation or a partnership, they could be included on the composite return, and they could take care of their Minnesota trust liability on the composite return rather than filing their own Minnesota separate return. It also, in order to qualify for this, also the only Minnesota source income these owners could have would be from this entity. So that's the first change. The second change is sort of a clarification of how, on a composite return, these non-residents, the entity figures out their Minnesota source income, and they pay us a tax on that net income at the highest possible Minnesota individual rate. And it is an election. But there's no real definition of how you figure this Minnesota net income that's assignable to Minnesota. This clarifies that in these situations, you take the Minnesota FAGI assignable income of the entity, you make modifications for bonus depreciation if they had any in the entity, and that's what you pay this tax percentage on. Section 3...
Mr. Haugen, I think it would be helpful for the members when we're talking about these changes, what precipitated the change or the need for the change. Obviously, we've been collecting taxes in the state of Minnesota for probably over 100 years, so why now?
Mr. Chairman, do you want me to go back to the first provision? I think I sort of...
The first provision I think you covered, electronic filing, saves the state money.
For Section 2, the reason that we're including the trust is some of the non-resident trusts, they have asked us to be included on the composite return. The current language in the statute technically says that they couldn't be included on the composite return, and it actually makes it easier for the taxpayer, it's an election by the taxpayer. It makes it easier for them to comply if they can be on the composite return, and it makes it easier for us. We just basically have one return, the entity return, instead of two, the entity return and the trust return. So we're simply more or less doing that way. For the changes in how we compute the taxable income, that is more, we get these questions all the time. And since there isn't a lot of clarification in the statute on how you come up with this, we thought it would be helpful to answer the questions and make it clear to the taxpayers that this is the way that you do it, so we're clarifying.
So if for those people who are scoring at home, this would be a pro-taxpayer provision?
Mr. Chairman, for most of them, it would be a pro-taxpayer decision. I mean, theoretically, you could have the situation where an S corporation had a lot of bonus depreciation that they had to add back in year one. In effect, since it's unclear, they could make the argument, well, I don't have to take that into account in figuring my Minnesota source income. correspondingly, if they had the next 5 years when they have the subtractions, it's not clear whether they'd get the subtractions on the composite return. So for those people, it would be a winner. So you can say that it's somewhat of a mixed bag.
Thank you.
Section 4 deals with corporate returns. We have these situations where you have, let's say, 8 corporations that are all part of a unitary group. They're all required to file their own, they all have to file their own returns, but they file on a combined basis. If one of these 8, let's say you have 8 corporations that are parents, subsidiary, brothers and sisters, they're all part of a unitary group, and let's say one of these 8 in the middle of the tax year is sold out to somebody else. Well, technically, they're supposed to file their return 2.5 months after the end of their tax year. That's almost an impossibility because they can't file their return until the combined units group's tax year ends. So what this provision does is it says for those types of situations where one of the subsidiaries goes and has a short tax year, they will have until the end, 2.5 months after the end of the unitary group's tax year to file their return. This is also a taxpayer-friendly provision. Section 6 is not a taxpayer-friendly provision. This is a change in the imposition of the a preparer penalty for a tax preparer willfully. The current law says that if a tax preparer willfully prepares a return that overstates the credit or understates the tax, that we can impose a $500 penalty. What the change is we're changing this and we're lowering the standard so that if the preparer, if the preparer either willfully or with negligent disregard of the rules and law prepares a return that understates or overstates a refund, they can get this $500 penalty. This language is fairly parallel with where the federal government can impose penalties on preparers, except that the federal level penalty, I think, is $1,000 rather than $500. Did I forget? Section 7 is another...
Excuse me one moment, Mr. Howden. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me how the term reckless disregard is currently used or applied in the courts? I know there are varying standards, and we're adding that. I'm just curious, what does that mean here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Colts, I think our problem is that in situations where we have just the standard of willful, you almost have to prove intent, which in some cases is very hard to do. So, for instance, if you have a preparer who is preparing returns for tax protesters who takes frivolous arguments. Some of these preparers are actually so into this idea that they don't owe any tax that they actually believe that they're not defrauding the government of tax revenue by filing these types of returns. So you might have a hard time proving intent in those situations. However, you wouldn't have a hard time proving that they recklessly disregarded the laws and the current case law saying that you can't take the position that I'm a resident, not a resident of the United States, and therefore don't owe any Minnesota tax. So it'd be in situations like that, or similarly, where you have a preparer who is not very well educated. He gets his instructions from somebody that sold him a package on how to sell or return preparation, and he's gotten sold a bill of goods. He goes out and prepares returns on that basis. If you can show that he should have known that this was just a bill of goods, we can probably impose this reckless disregard penalty.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the concern that I have is, are we setting up a situation where we have a mom-and-pop business, a restaurant or a bar or a liquor store, and their business is running their business. They hire somebody to handle their accounting needs, their bookkeeping needs, and the preparer makes an error that the business owner doesn't know about, doesn't understand, but they don't necessarily, you know, do everything that they could have done to catch this error. Are we imposing potentially imposing liability on that person for the mistake made by the preparer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, this is a penalty that's imposed on the preparer. It's not imposed on the individual taxpayer. So in that case, It's not the individual taxpayer that we're talking about. When we get to Section 7, we'll talk about the actual individual taxpayer. This is a penalty that we put on the H&R Block company that fraudulently prepares a return. That's probably a bad example because they do a fairly good job. But it's on the preparer. It's not the individual taxpayer doesn't get any penalty for this return that's bogus.
Mr. Chair.
Examples.
Just so I'm clear then, on page 8, lines 3 through, down to the end of, 3 through 9, it reads, these penalties may not be assessed against the employer of a tax return preparer unless the employer was actively involved in the reckless disregard. So you're talking there about the person who's
So we're talking
not the client, not the person who signs the contract with the entity that's preparing the return, but you're talking about the preparer's immediate supervisor. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct. Okay. So for instance, if you had an office where you're preparing returns and you had 5 employees and you had one employee who was a bad egg and was making up Schedule C's or whatever to qualify for the earned income credit, that person, the supervisor might not be, they wouldn't be liable for this, but that one person that was preparing the bogus returns would be. Section 7 deals with...
Excuse me, Representative Stephen, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. I'm sorry, let's continue then.
Section 7 is a brand new penalty. It deals with the situation where a taxpayer is claiming one of Minnesota's refundable credits. Those are your education credit, your dependent care credit, your working family credit, and your property tax refund. Under the current law, all of our penalties, even for fraud, are based on a percentage of the tax that's going to the tax that wasn't paid. With the property tax refund and with a lot of these working family credit, dependent care credit, education credit, the taxpayers don't have any tax, and they're just claiming a refund. So if we catch them in processing and say, you know, this working family credit that you claimed, you're saying you've got 2 kids and you don't have any, and you fraudulently made up this return, the penalty on that taxpayer is absolutely, it's 50% of their taxes due. Their tax due is zero, so there's no penalty. What this provision is trying to get at is trying to put some sort of a bar on these taxpayers, or put the fear of God in them, or the fear of the Department of Revenue, and that we can actually do something to them. What this provision provides for is if the taxpayer fraudulently claims one of these credits, we can go in after we catch them and we can say to that taxpayer, you can't claim that credit for the next 10 years. If they claim the credit with net reckless disregard, we could bar them for 2 years from claiming that specific credit. Now, it should be pointed out that this is conduct by the taxpayer. So if you went into a tax preparer, and let's say that you were rather unsophisticated, and the tax preparer sold you this bill of goods that was fraudulent, but you thought that and didn't have any reason to believe that it wasn't kosher, you wouldn't get this penalty. The preparer might get the penalty we talked about in Section 6, but they wouldn't get this penalty. So that's that provision.
Mr. Chairman?
The next provision...
Excuse me, Mr. Hogan, Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Haugen, I understand what you're getting at, but what if you had a corporation that fraudulently claimed that they were had a foreign operating corporation subsidiary? You going to bar them for 10 years from taking that tax treatment too, or is this just for poor people who say that they have 2 kids when they have none?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, this only would apply to the refundable credits, which you're correct are basically low income provisions for low income individual taxpayers. So it would not apply to C corporations who more or less fraudulently claim, or maybe not fraudulently, but claim tax liabilities that are much less than they actually should be. Those situations, there would be a tax that's due when we assess them, and if they fraudulently took it, we could assess a monetary penalty of 50% of the tax that they got out from under.
So, Mr. Chairman, could you tell me why the penalty ought to be greater for a refundable credit than it is for just a regular fraudulent tax return if a taxpayer prepares. Just put aside the FOC, but fraud is fraud. And what you're saying is that for this cluster, and I understand how difficult it is to administer the refundable credits, understand that that is the number one non-compliance item that the department has gone through. But I'm also interested in the equity in treating similar conduct similarly. And I don't necessarily disagree with a pretty strong penalty here, but I'm trying to understand maybe some of the other penalties ought to be kicked up a notch for, you know, not a usual disagreement, which is going to happen from time to time, but the language here is fraudulent or reckless disregard. And why should those taxpayers be treated any differently than these taxpayers for similar conduct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, we understand that the 10-year, more or less, bar or the 2-year bar is a fairly stiff penalty. You know, is a fairly stiff penalty for these people. Or it might not be any penalty at all if, for instance, they were claiming children that they didn't have and they didn't have a child for 10 years. It probably doesn't have any effect on them at all. But you're correct. It is a stiff penalty. We did go and have discussions about whether the alternative would be to put a monetary penalty in that would be based on the refund that they claimed. So, for instance, if they claimed a $2,000 education credit and they didn't have any children, we would say that they'd have a penalty of $1,000. We were rather reluctant to do that because in a lot of cases these people actually are very low income and we'd have a hard time collecting the $1,000 monetary penalty that we did impose. So, you know, we have discussed various alternatives to this, and this is what we came up with at this point in time.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Evans, also, I'm not sure if John mentioned, but this is mirrored after the IRS program that's been in place, I think, since 2002. And so they have the same penalty, the 10 years and also the 2 years for reckless disregard. So we're kind of piggybacking that program. The taxpayer also has appeal rights under this penalty. And also, if you look at the effective date, we are it's only for credits or refunds claimed after December 31st, 2005. So we want to make sure it was prospective only. But like John said, this is a stiff penalty. When we were coming forward with this, there was a lot of discussion, you know, whether we should even bring it to the legislature, but we thought it's good to have this discussion and get it out there, and if there's other options that would work, we're sure open to other fixes as well. But this is one similar to the IRS we thought we'd present to the committee.
Mr. Haugen, I presume from the language what you're saying here is that if you had a fraudulent claim for an education tax credit, that then you would be barred for participating in the education tax credit for the ensuing 2 years, not necessarily the working family credit or dependent care credit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So, for instance, if you claim a working family credit that was fraudulent, we would say that you couldn't have the working family credit for 10 years. If we could only show that it was with net reckless disregard, it would only be 2 years. But you could still claim your property tax refund unless you fraudulently filed one of those.
Okay. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my apologies. I'm not going to be near as sophisticated in my questioning as Representative Abrams, but two pieces. One is, as I'm looking at the previous section that we just reviewed, applying to preparers in this, I'm not seeing the phrase willful in this section, but I do in the previous section. I'm not understanding the significance of that, and I'm wondering if the testifiers could speak to the difference there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there really probably isn't any difference. In order to prove a fraudulent claim for refund, there would have to be an intentional claiming of the refund that you knew that you weren't entitled to. A willful overstating of the credit would be basically the same thing. I think in that sense, there's not any real difference.
One more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, just to not to put too fine a point on it, but if I incorrectly claim a credit of some sort this year, and I'm penalized for either 2 or 10 years out, even if I become eligible for that credit within that time period, I'm ineligible to claim it. Am I correct in my understanding?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Holland, I don't know tax law definitions. Maybe is fraud, proof of fraud in tax law totally different from proof of fraud in civil law? Or I mean, there's a big difference between willful and fraud in the civil law sense, but it's pretty hard to prove the fraud. Is it much easier in the tax law sense or something?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, it's always, you know, whether it's, in order to prove that it was willful, you almost have to prove that it was, you intentionally did this. You willfully knew that you were taking something that you weren't entitled to. And in that sense, it's just as hard. In this sense, it's just as hard to prove civil fraud or civil willful. In the criminal sense, you know, the burden of proof is different. You have to prove by the preponderance of evidence. In civil, you just have to prove our beyond reasonable doubt in criminal, and only beyond our preponderance of the evidence in the civil situation.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, maybe it doesn't make any difference. It's easier to prove willful in civil case than it is to prove common law fraud in a civil case. Maybe it doesn't matter, and I think in this case, since you're requiring fraud before you take it away, that's probably better than the easiest standard.
There are no further questions on Section 7.
Mr. Chairman, Section 8 deals with additions for individuals, trusts, and estates when they're figuring out their Minnesota income tax return. The changes that we're making here, there's a change where we're saying instead of having to add back the expenses attributable to U.S. interest. So, if, for instance, if you borrow money to purchase U.S. obligations, which are the interest upon which are exempt from Minnesota tax, here what we're saying is you don't have to make the addition for the expenses attributable to the U.S. interest under this provision. Instead, what you do is down in Section 10 when we get to it. Is that you just take a deduction, or you just take a deduction or a subtraction for the net amount of U.S. interest? You're coming down to the same place, but you're doing it in a different way. And we thought the statute would be clearer doing it this way. So that's the one change. The other change came out of this is a carryover from last year's tax bill that we proposed, where you have this concept of net income or taxes paid to another state on net income. We use that term, income taxes paid to another state, in a number of different places. And what we're trying to do with the change here is make this consistent with the term net income taxes paid to another state in the credit for taxes paid to another state credit provisions. So that we're, and also with the corporate modification for adding back state income taxes paid. So that's what we're trying to do, the two things we're trying to do in this section. Section 9 deals with subtractions from federal taxable income. In this section, there are three things that we're doing. One is, as I mentioned before, you take your subtraction for U.S. government interest, instead of having an addition for the expenses attributable to the U.S. interest up in Section 8, you will now be taking the net down as a subtraction in Section 9. One of the other things we're doing is in the situation where you have a corporation that was a C corporation, they were required to make an add back for bonus depreciation. If that C corporation under the current law becomes an S corporation, there is no longer an entity that gets to take the subtractions over the next 5 years to make up for that add back of the bonus depreciation. This, the provision that's in this section would say that in that situation, the shareholders of the corporation, which is now an S corporation and the income is flowing through, will get their share of the C corporation's old subtraction for bonus depreciation. The third thing that we're doing is we're eliminating a subtraction. There was a subtraction in the Minnesota law where if you worked in the youth services program, that program, you worked as a student or while you were, before you were in school, you would work in these community service projects. You didn't get any pay until you left the service. But then when you left the service and you went on to school, the government would pay for part of your education. Federally, that would have been taxable income. Minnesota had a provision saying that you got a subtraction for that. We're getting rid of the subtraction here because right now and for the last couple of years, nobody has gotten those types of funds. They just aren't available, so those payments are no longer being made, so there's nothing really to subtract.
Mr. Harden, just excuse me on that last provision. The federal program still exists?
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, I think the federal and the state programs still exist, but there is absolutely no funding, and there's, from what we've heard, there's no, there isn't any talk of refunding it. I assume that if it was refunded, we could talk about putting the subtraction back in again. Although, so, I don't know that the department would.
So I guess the question would be, if the program still exists, even if it's not funded, what happens, and is this something that if the program, or if there was funding for the program reinstated, that we would want to relook at the issue or not?
Mr. Chairman, that would be, you would have the option of, at that point, we'd be looking at this, putting back this subtraction.
Okay. Representative Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering how this would apply. It sounds like a similar program as either the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps. So how would this modification affect that, where it's similarly where you don't get paid for your service, but then once you complete your two-year commitment, I think it is, you can, the government helps pay for some of your education expenses.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stephen, those provisions weren't covered to the extent that those, what you got from those programs after you left was taxable federally. Under current Minnesota law, those would be taxable for Minnesota. To the extent that they were exempt for federal purposes, they would be exempt from Minnesota. But this was specific to this Youth Community Services program.
Thank you.
Okay, let's continue.
Section 10 deals with modifications to corporate taxable income. What we're doing is we're getting rid of one modification where you were required to add back the environmental tax that you paid. There hasn't been an environmental tax for since 96. So we're getting rid of that deadwood in the statute. The other thing that we're doing is, in this provision, we're citing to the Internal Revenue Code 168K, which is bonus depreciation. We're being more specific as to which clauses of the Internal Revenue Code actually give you the deduction for bonus depreciation. Section 11, I sort of hit on when we were talking about Section 8. This is where we're changing more or less the how we define income taxes paid to another state. It also changes a site to the definition of resident that was changed in Subdivision 7 to make it more up-to-date. Section 12 deals with the education credit. In the old education credit, we more or less cited to a law on the education provisions that gave us a laundry list of types of areas of study that would qualify for tutoring, that you could get tutoring and you'd get the education credit. When the education statute changed in 2003, they moved this laundry list of course set areas of study were found, and so we're just changing the site to the where it currently is in the Minnesota statute. Section 13 deals with the minimum fee that's paid by corporations and partnerships. What happened here is that co-ops, not coops, are exempt from the minimum fee. And the way that this exemption for co-ops was drafted was that they had to be in a co-op that was organized under Chapter 308A, which was the only place you could become a co-op when it was initially, when our exemption was initially passed. A couple of years ago, they put in an alternate way of becoming a co-op under Chapter 308B, and this just clarifies that whether you become a co-op under 308A or B, you're going to be exempt from the minimum fee. Sections 14 and 15 deal with the estate tax. This is a situation where our current Minnesota estate tax is based on the federal taxable estate. There, what happens is before 2005, and a death in those years, you got a credit for the amount of taxes that you paid to a state. In 2005, federally, what happens is it starts out that you're going to, instead of getting a credit, you're going to get a deduction for the state taxes, the state death taxes that you paid. So what happens is you have this situation where we're basing on our tax on the federal taxable income that has a deduction for the state taxes that you pay, which gets you into a circular computation, which is very difficult to do. So we're more or less clarifying that you aren't going to get a deduction for the state death taxes when you're computing your Minnesota estate tax. Section 16 is a repealer of some obsolete rules. These rules deal with declarations of estimated tax payments by corporations. What these declarations were in the old days was is at the beginning of the year, the corporation would give us a piece of paper saying, okay, I'm going to be making payments of X amount of dollars per quarter. We no longer require these declarations, so the rules are no longer of any use, and so we're asking that they be repealed.
To this section 16, probably the question goes better to Mr. Manson. Why are we repealing rules in statute? There's a provision for you to repeal rules. Why would you come here to have rules repealed?
I think I'll probably answer that,
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, going through you is a lot cheaper and a lot faster than going through the rulemaking process.
You don't know that yet.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in the past it has been that way.
That's 3 points.
Okay. That's your current belief. All right. So, I guess is maybe the question is to the former chairs of the tax committee, you repealed rules in the technical bill, Mr. Abrams or Mr. Anderson?
Every opportunity, Representative Krenke.
Whenever you
could. Representative Krenke, what the department will do is they'll just go to the state government finance committee and say that it costs more and ask for more administrative costs in order to be able to run the department. So it's a lot cheaper this way.
Representative Abrams, it's just like playing Hollywood Squares. I'd go for the block. Okay, let's continue then with the Article 2.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lance DeRica. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'll be doing part of Article 2 with Ms. Sims. I'll be starting out. Section 1 is part of a package involving Sections 1, 36, 47, 48, 49, 51, and 52. A lot of verbiage and a lot of provisions here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 7 sections. But really what we're doing is two things.
We're providing procedures for the Metropolitan Council with regard to the various population and population-related estimates that they do. So 10 seconds of background. We have a state demographer who provides population-related estimates, but we also have the Met Council doing some of those things in the metropolitan area. The role of the Metropolitan Council has kind of grown up ad hocly, and there is no statute that really lays out the procedures by which they do these population estimates, whether the local units have appeal rights for those estimates, and if so, how long, and that sort of thing. So we're providing a statute, Section 47, Minnesota Statute 473-24, that lays this out for the Metropolitan Council. The other thing we're doing is changing the date by which for the estimate that we will use for local government aid. Currently, it's June. These estimates as of June 1st. In the course of creating this new statute, laying out procedures for the Met Council, and making sure that that's parallel with what the state demographer does for the non-metro area, there was some give and take. And the bottom line is we're changing the date by which we will use these estimates for local government aid purposes to June 15th, regardless if there was some later change or not. And all of those provisions will be effective the day following final enactment.
Okay. Representative Muller, a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Strika, how is that handled right now? How is it done by every year that the population change affects the computation of all these things, and how does the Met Council do the computation now as compared to how they're going to do it? I mean, I haven't had a chance to read through here.
I'm sure I cannot, I apologize, but I cannot give you the 600-page version of all of that. Metropolitan Council produces a lot of population estimates. Population over 65, number of households, and those, and maybe others. And those estimates are used for a number of different purposes: local government aid, the fiscal disparities program. Those are the only two I can think of right now. But I think they might also be used for welfare aids or in the past. And the basic scenario is that once every 10 years there's a census in Minnesota, and in the interim, either the state demographer or the Met Council for the metropolitan area produces those estimates of population over 65, number of households, that kind of thing. Each year that there isn't a census, the state demographer and the Met Council produces those estimates that I've just mentioned for these different purposes. For a state demographer, there is a existing statute, 4802, that lays out the dates by which, let's take population for example, and I'm going to butcher the dates, but there is a statute that lays out that every year the state demographer has to let the city and town know what its estimate is by April sometime, I believe it is. There's a certain amount of time for the local units to get back to the Met Council. We think you're wrong, we'd like, you know, and so forth. And then there's another date by which that must be resolved. In the case of the Met Council, their role in producing those population and related estimates, as I see it, grew up kind of ad hocly. The fiscal disparity statute will say that the Met Council produces the populations that we use to distribute the tax base. But there is no central statute to tell us the Met Council what date you have to do these by, whether you have to let the local units appeal or not, and if they do, when does that wrap up? And just to go on this a little bit, in 2003, we had a situation arise where someone was questioning their population for local government aid purposes, and that population had been produced by as an estimate by the Met Council, and there was not a statute to guide us as to when that had to be, when we fish or cut bait for local government aid purposes. We've got to compute local government aid so people know how to set their levy for the next year. In all of this talk, I apologize, I've forgotten exactly what your question was, but that's what we're doing. We're providing a statute for the Met Council that has all these procedures and dates in them.
parallel to the state department.
Mr. Chairman, I'll follow up outside of this.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it does make sense if we're going to have two separate entities doing population projections that it be put placed in statute, but I guess I question why we have two separate groups doing population projections for separate areas of the state. I've had this question before, and I guess I continue to have the question. I don't need it answered. I guess I wanted to just make a comment regarding having the metropolitan area have one group making population projections and greater Minnesota having another.
In that same vein, I guess my question would track along with Representative Broad. Why would you not have the Metropolitan Council report their estimates to the state demographer and have the state demographer certify those rather than having the Metropolitan Council, as I understand, as I believe this is written, have the Metropolitan Council certify those numbers to the department?
Mr. Chair, I do not believe the department has a position on that. We're more or less taking the situation that was handed to us and trying to put some dates into statute so that we can work with that process. If the process should change or responsibilities change in that process, that probably would not be a department concern.
Okay. No further questions. Let's continue then to Section 2.
Section 2 provides a definition for taxes levied in the case of mobile home taxes for the purpose of this certification that must be provided before the title can be changed. Section 3 put the reference in the statute so that the range area fiscal disparity values are reported to the commissioner on what to us is a very fundamental document, the abstracts of assessment. Right now they don't have a specific reference to that program.
Again, my name is Harriet Sims with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I will be going through the next several sections, beginning with Section 4. Section 4 is a technical house cleaning provision. In 2003, we amended the statute to require at least one-fifth of parcels listed to be appraised each year. The prior standard had been at least one-fourth. And at that time, we thought that we had picked up all of the statutes that referred to a quartile or a one-fifth requirement, but we found one where it still refers to one-fourth, and we are changing that to one-fifth to be consistent. The next slew of sections, if you're following along in the summary, sections 5, part of Section 6, Section 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 26 are all cross-references to various property tax exemptions that already... These exemptions already exist in statute, but they're not in the main statute that deals with property tax exemptions. And so we are making these cross-references. The purpose behind this is so that somebody who is reading the statute and looking in the logical place for property tax exemptions will be able to find them all rather than having to look all through Minnesota statutes to pick those up. And so that does not create any exemptions that were not already in the statute. Section 6, part of that was included in my presentation, but the other part of, I believe it's Section 6 or Section 7, for the purely public charity, institutions of purely public charity?
7.
Okay. So I've already spoken about Section 6, and Lance will discuss Section 7, institutions of purely public charity, because this part is not merely a cross-reference.
Section 7 adds some language that the department thinks is a part of the qualification for institutions of purely public charity with regard to low-income housing. With the elimination of the Class 4D low-income housing class for taxes payable in 2004, it was felt there was some need to clarify that these types of government assistance to the tenants and government assistance to the landlord are not gifts or donate free will, unconditional donations for the purposes of deciding who's exempt as a purely public charity. That became an issue with the elimination of the Class 4D. So the Section 7 with that new language is effective for taxes payable 2004 and thereafter.
The next section, going according to the summary, Section 15, we are putting in a definition of installed capacity for purposes of determining qualification for a utility personal property tax exemption. And the definition, we are defining this as generator nameplate capacity. That definition comes from the Energy Information Administration and is an industry-used definition. And it's simply the amount of capacity of the generator then that would be on its nameplate, and it's got a technical definition that everybody in the industry would know. Next, Section 16 is we are changing the reporting dates for the wind energy production tax. The reason we are doing this is that it will allow the Department of Revenue to notify companies and counties earlier. The earlier notification will help townships to better anticipate their wind energy property tax revenues for the following year when they adopt levies. So the annual reporting date was March 1st. It's going to be February 1st. And the deadline for the Department of Revenue then to notify the companies and the counties was March 31st, and it'll be now February 28th. And this is effective for the reports and certifications due in 2006 and thereafter. Section 17 is a new distribution formula for the wind energy production tax. The current statute distributed those revenues in the proportion of the current year tax rates. This change would use set percentages, and those percentages are 80% to counties, 14% to cities and townships, and 6% to school districts. These percentages are close to what they were in the first year. One of the changes that we think is clarification is that the state would not be included in this. And the reason for this is that the state isn't actually a taxing jurisdiction for this purpose. So it is it would be effective for the clarification dealing with the state for distributions in 2004 and 2005, and it's effective the day following final enactment for the rest of it. Section.
Excuse me, Ms. Sims, just Representative Rukavina has a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just wondering about this because it seems to me to be more than some type of technical correction, and I'm just wondering if the witness can explain why revenue is proposing this. I don't know much about wind energy, but I'm sure if somebody like Representative Conan or someone around here, and why the department is determining what those percentages should be when there must have been some type of legislative intent as to what the formula, distribution formula was.
You want to give us, Ms. Sims, give us some background as to why this policy change?
Okay. Chairman and Representative Rukavina, I believe the philosophy behind this would be to use the set percentages so that there wouldn't be so much fluctuation from year to year. but I will ask for help from one of our more technical, the oriented people who can give you the full history of this provision.
Well, Mr. Chair, the only wind on the range is me, but you know, but it could change.
It's not blowing up there today?
Pardon me?
It's not blowing up there today?
No.
Okay.
Regular hurricane.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Nord. I work in the Property Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. And the problem that we've encountered with wind energy production taxes is a situation where a township's levy actually drives how much production tax it's going to receive. And so basing production tax distributions on any year's levy amounts is going to create a seesaw effect in the amount of production taxes that they receive. And so it becomes this game where even if you use the previous year's tax rates, you'd have to, if you raise your levy in 1 year, the subsequent year you're going to get an extra benefit in terms of your wind energy production taxes. And so then presumably you would lower your levy in the subsequent year to account for the increase in revenues, but that then in turn would create a reduction in your production taxes for the subsequent year. So you'd create the seesaw effect where just to hit a stable budget amount, you'd be raising and lowering your property taxes so that you could raise in accordance with the amount of production taxes that you were going to receive. So we talked about a number of options on how to best approach that issue, and we thought that the best solution was to set some percentages so that townships could more easily identify how much production tax revenues that they would receive, and then they could set their levy according to what their budget target actually is.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe Representative Abrams or Representative Anderson or somebody can help me, but that seems, I don't know, Representative Abrams, it seems like it's more than a technical deal here, or, you know, I don't know, I mean, did to come up with the 80 did you average county and township and city taxes in that area, or... Because this seems like it's way more than just technical corrections.
First of all, Representative Rukavina, there are some policy changes in the bill. You notice on the summary, that at the top of the summary it says that if you have an asterisk, it indicates that it's a technical proposal, that if you have a... the other sign there, it's a carry forward from the 2004 Department of Revenue technical bill or policy bill, which they just indicate that those were items that were discussed last year. Not obviously, there was no final resolution. And where you have neither one of those, that is a new policy being brought forward by the department this year. So. Representative Abrams, did you want to comment on this particular policy change?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think what Mr. Nord said is correct. I think one thing that members have to keep in mind when you're talking about the role of the Department of Revenue in wind energy is that at the county's request a number of years ago, the department now does the assessment of those parcels that produce wind energy because... some of the companies were taking some small counties to court and incurring hundreds of thousands of dollars of legal fees on the counties. Now, one of the things that's happened because of that is that the counties work very closely with the department on some of these policies, and I would be surprised if this is something that just came out of the blue. I would suspect, Mr. Nord, that this is something that has been discussed with the counties and the townships and the school districts in the area, and that... they're okay with it, and probably as part of your ongoing discussions in this pretty Byzantine area.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, yes, we've had a little bit of discussion. I don't know that we've thoroughly talked to every group to make sure that we have full agreement from all parties, but at least we've made our best effort here to come up with a change that has the minimal impact on the counties, minimal impact on the townships, have attempted to protect their interests as much as possible.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons that you put the bill in early and have it sitting out there is so that if there is a problem with a provision like this one, that the counties and the townships and the school districts in the area will have an opportunity to come in. I would suspect that Representative Keenan and Representative Seifert and the others who represent Wind Country we'll have conversations with their local elected officials and find out their reaction to the provision before the committee is in a position to act on it. But I think it's very good, Representative Rupavina, that you flag this provision, but there's a whole lot of history about taxation and wind energy in the state, and just keep on doing it until we're able to get it right. But I think what Mr. Nord said has a lot of validity, that if you could set some percentages, you'll be rationalizing the income stream and making a budget setting a little bit easier. But I'm sure we'll hear from counties, townships, and school districts if that's incorrect.
Chair, I don't know what the formula or the taxes are for wind, but I'm wondering if we put one tax on wind around the Capitol, if we could balance the budget this year.
Not likely, Representative. Any further questions on Section 17? If not, let's move on.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The next few sections, Section 18, 19, and 20, are cross-references to cooperatives. John Haugen earlier alluded to a similar operation that we were doing in the income tax. For property tax classification and homestead exemption eligibility, cooperatives are eligible, or more better way to say it, yeah, you know, housing units that are, you know, in a cooperative could be eligible for the homestead classification, although the statute only refers to cooperatives that are organized under Chapter 308A. And in, I believe it was in 2003 or may have been 2002, they added a new Chapter 308B, a new way to form cooperatives. The differences between 308A and 308B are irrelevant for the homestead exemptions, and so we are cross-referencing and stating that you can be a cooperative organized under 308B as well as 308A, and this particular one is what we would consider a technical change.
Section 20, excuse me. Section 21 amends the homestead for land owned by limited liability companies so that the homestead is a possibility only for limited liability companies that operate a family farm. Section 24 amends a provision allowing homestead when property owned by a trust is leased by a limited liability company, partnership, or corporation, and requiring that the person, in order for the property to get homestead, the person farming that land must be related to the person who created the trust. Section 22 amends the homestead penalties. Again, there's some amount of verbiage here. What's going on is two things. First of all, we're adding a time limit to the penalty for improper homesteads. We can only impose a penalty for an improper homestead or a fraudulent homestead for the current year and the prior 5 years. We are also adding a second level penalty. Right now, the law provides a penalty only in the case of fraudulent homesteads. And that's 100% penalty of the homestead benefits. We're changing that to 50% because that's more consistent with the penalties in the other tax types such as income and sales. And then we're adding a lower level penalty in the case of negligence, which would be 10% of the homestead benefits. And those provisions would be effective for determinations made July 1st, 2005 and thereafter. Section 22 also contains at the end a laundry list of information that the counties must provide to the commissioner by electronic means starting in April of 2006. This information will eventually lead to homeowner property tax refund claimants not having to include a paper copy of the property tax statement with their property tax refund claim.
Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just wondering, are all counties capable at the current time of sending things to you electronically, or is this another mandate on counties?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I've been led to believe that the counties are comfortable with this new requirement for them to send us this information starting in 2006. I've not been made aware of any county that would not be able to do this. I would include something along the lines that they provide a lot of information to us now electronically, and that this would not be something that they can't do also. If I'm missing anything, perhaps someone from the department could raise their hand. I don't see anybody objecting to me.
Okay. Let's move on then. Section 23.
Section 23 deals with a special agricultural homestead. The current statute provides that if you've got agricultural land of 40 acres or more that is actively farmed by its owner, it's eligible for this homestead treatment. And this is not in the normal homestead. The person would actually have to live on the land, and in this one it's special because the person doesn't need to. And what we are doing, or we are attempting to do, is add a definition of what is actively farming. And the language that you see on page 52 of the bill, lines 24 to 31, we had talked with staff, and we are going to be revising that language to get a better definition of exactly what is farmable land. But the concept is that it's land that is tillable land plus pasture land which you would normally be growing crops on, and pasture. And the actively farming portion, we are adding the definition that if the applicable people, such as the owner, owner's spouse, son or daughter of the owner's spouse, is actively farming over 50% of this land, they would qualify for that classification.
We call this the Schwigum provision?
I am. Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of that. But this is, I guess you could say that this one is under construction, and we have been interpreting the statute generally in this way, that they would have to be actively farming over 50% of the land to qualify, and we thought that was reasonable, and we are open to other suggestions.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, under that definition, would you consider actively farming acres that are enrolled in CRP? Although they are inactive acres, they are an active part of the farm. The revenues generated off of the CRP enrollment go into the bottom line of the farm each year. So I'm wondering how that would play, or if you've considered how that would add into the definition of actively farming.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, we had interpreted that those acres would not be considered to be acres of the actively farming CRP, the RIM, and CRE, Conservation Reserve Enhancement Programs, all of those would not be included.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Under this proposal.
Representative Dill.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Sims, would the the way that's written is that 50% of the 40 or 50% over of the land over 40 acres. It says the agricultural land of 40 acres or more. I'm just trying to figure that out.
Yeah, it's representative, Mr. Chair, that would be 50 over 50% of that 40 acres. So they would have to have at least 40 acres. Over whatever, one dirt ball over 20.
So, Chairman, so I understand you could do the 20 acres of the 40 and you'd qualify for this case.
I believe that's the way it would work. There may be, and here, Representative, I may be going out of my depth on this, but there could be situations where that might not qualify. I can't think of any.
The assessor is going to be out there with a measuring stick. Find out how many acres you've actually tilled. So.
Yes, Representative. I believe that would be the situation because it would have to be over 50% of that portion of the 40 that is farmable or that is capable of being farmed. So you could have some land where a small amount of that 40, very small amount of that 40 was not capable of being farmed, and you could go below an amount that could reasonably be farmed. For instance, if only 5 acres of that 40 were farmable, we wouldn't say that you have that classification because you were actively farming 3 acres of that 40.
The assessor is also going to have to show up in August or September. Representative Mueller, you have a question on the section?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I missed coming in. Maybe I missed it, but and we don't have a lot of farmland in North Minneapolis, so I'm not real familiar with this. But I don't see the word actively farmed in the actual bill, the actively, and I was wondering what that meant in the report, but also it does say farmed by the qualified applicant, and I just wondered what that meant. I know some places, like I think it's in the, for instance, in the estate tax exemption for farmed by the family, being farmed by the family includes if they rent it out and they have an active participation in deciding what crops and things like that go into it. What does this mean here, farmed by the qualified applicant?
Representative Mullery and Chairman Prinke, farmed by the qualified applicant would be that list of people that, and it's in the existing, language, that would be if it's the owner, the owner's spouse, son or daughter of the owner's spouse.
You can't have a migrant worker farming it and still qualify for it, similar.
Well, that was, Mr. Chairman, that was my question, Kim, whether it's not migrant or whether it's rented to somebody, it does, or whether it's rented to somebody, it does. Does the one of these people, owner or spouse, et cetera, what do they have to do, or do they actually have to go out and, you know, run the plow and... Or can it be leased out or something, or somebody else working?
Representative Mullery and Chairman Krinke, I would like to introduce John Hagen from the Property Tax Division, who has done a lot of work in developing some of these questions and teaching to our assessors.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, John Hagen with the Department of Revenue. I work in property tax. In answer to your question, as I understood it, yes, the people that are the qualified persons who can qualify for that tulip farming provision have to do the actual work. They have to, we basically say they have to make the financial decisions and they have the dirt underneath their fingernails to demonstrate they are actually doing the farming.
So they have to run the plow or the...
Exactly.
That's what I said, we call this the Schwiggum provision.
Well,
anybody seen him actively farming anytime? Okay. Representative Muller, you have any follow-up then? Okay. Representative Simpson.
Just to follow up on the question I think that Mr. Zellers asked, on the farm, the example would be a 200-acre farm that a retired couple owns. They live on the property, and they have it all in CRP. So you're telling me they won't qualify then for ag credit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is where it gets really complicated, and I apologize. The actively farming provision only applies to persons who do not live on the farm. It was an offshoot of the 1997 floods in the Red River Valley, where they realized, the legislature realized, it sometimes didn't make sense for certain persons to live on their farm. So in 1997, it was implemented, it was expanded in 1999 to deal with the tornadoes in St. Peter, and shortly after that, it was expanded to the entire state. In your situation, it would not be actively farming. That would just be persons who actually occupy the farmland, and they could have their property in CRP or RIM and continue to receive the Ag Homestead so long as it was agricultural prior to the enrollment in CRP or RIM.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little concerned about the actively farming part. Is there a qualifier for percentage or, you know, our family has a farm. I don't know that my stepdad actually gets dirt under his fingernails, but as a bigger farmer, sometimes you don't actually, you know, management is more than necessarily the manual part of running a farm. So is there a percentage qualifier that someone's going to get in trouble with this later on, or is this just a little leery? Anytime someone from the government talks to farmers and says, trust me, it makes my radar go up. So I'm just curious if there's some sort of percentage or a qualifier in there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is no percentage. Since it is a reasonably new law, we are still working the kinks out, but we thought it was important, and we worked closely with legislative staff in trying to interpret this, but we thought it was important that since it was a huge expansion from the original homestead concept where you could receive the Ag Homestead class, which is very, very significant, and not live on the farm, live up to within four townships of the farm, that we wanted to make sure it was pretty closely policed so that persons who were claiming to actually be farming were actually farming the land. So basically, we say they have to make management decisions. They have to be involved in the day-to-day farm operations. And believe it or not, that has worked out quite well. We haven't really been challenged.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Muller.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that raised because the answer to Representative Zeller's question was the opposite of what my understanding of my question was. And therefore, I think we certainly need to develop this language because my understanding from the answer to his question is the opposite of what the answer to mine was. He was asking if they're big enough they have employees or, a lot, as he said, huge numbers of farms, they're just the owners making decisions. They're not out running the plow, and your answer to mine was that they're out actually doing that they can't have somebody else doing it. And so there's a... If you're the one in charge of this language and you're giving two different answers, I think we need to flush this out before we pass this bill. Okay. And hopefully you'll come up with language that will clarify this issue.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I did not intend to give different answers. My answer to both questions is that the person who is claiming actively farming has to be involved in the day-to-day farm management and operations and involved in the actual day-to-day farm operations and actually doing the farm work. Now, that does not mean that they could not hire additional people to help them, you know, on a big operation where one person's incapable of doing all that, but they have to, on their own, be involved in making financial decisions, and that's not enough. They have to be involved in the actual day-to-day labor of the farm as well, driving tractors, whatever that encompasses.
Representative Muller.
Mr. Chairman, I still think this needs clarification in the language before we pass something.
Representative Vandeveer, did you want to see this in the division? Is that what you're...
That wasn't my intent, Mr. Chairman. We can argue about it here, but I did. I guess it isn't clear to me either. If Representative Zeller's dad hires a manager for his farm to run the farm for him and talks to him every day and tells him, you know, how many cows or whatever the deal is and tells him what to do and how to do it, but he isn't there the whole day with him, I mean, does this qualify or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the way we interpret this provision of the law is, number one, if the father did not live on the farm, that would put him in the actively farming criteria. If he lived on the farm, all this is moot. If he does not live on the farm and he hires a manager and is not personally engaged in the day-to-day activities of the farm, that is working on the farm, if he just delegates all that to an employee, he would not qualify for actually farming.
That's pretty... Delegating to an employee is running and operating typically, so this is not, I mean, from my experience, so this, if it is an employee as opposed to contracting it out or leasing it or something like that, so this is kind of different from my understanding of, you know, once you have an employee and you're directing the employee, you're considered to be operating, but you're changing that. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct. We've been faced with the question if a person just is responsible for the management decisions of the farm and does not actually farm it, we've answered in the negative that they do not qualify.
Representative Zellers.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, for starting something here. So to follow up on Representative Vandeveer's question, so if you do have a manager, however, the manager only advises you as to what would be, you can choose to obviously most places you probably wouldn't disagree with him, but if he says, you know, you've put in 1,000 acres of barley this year and 1,000 acres of corn, leaf soybeans alone, you choose to, you know, go 1,000 and then maybe put in 500 acres of some wheat or something, you technically then made the decision. You technically then fall under the actively farming.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I got a little confused in the question, but
okay. So, say your manager gives you a recommendation on what to plant and what chemicals to put on. You go, you say yes, and authorize he or she to do that. You are then actively farming.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you would certainly be participating in the management decisions as long as you did participate in actually farming the land in some role. That would be actually farming.
Miss Baker, would you like to try to help us understand who's farming what where?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Microphone, sorry.
When this provision came about, I think the whole rationale of it was that it was, first of all, the whole issue here is to give a person a homestead that is not living on the farm. And it started with kind of the movement off the farm where, you know, a couple decided they didn't want to live on the farm. They wanted to live in town because maybe one of the spouses worked at the school and they had kids and it was just easier for them to live. And so they said, it's not fair that we are living off the farm and we're not getting homestead benefits, even though we are the farmers. We are doing everything on the farm. It's just that we live off the farm. So that kind of opened up this whole actively farming, and the legislature over a series of many, many meetings and many, many hours and hours of kind of discussions said, what do we mean by actively farming? And the conclusion was that the person had to be actively involved, and I don't think we haven't specified that in statute, right? It's just the department has issued a lot of different guidelines and a lot of information to the county assessors to try and, you know, determine what all that is. But over the course of it, keep in mind that it's only if you live off the farm. Now, the other thing is you have to live within a certain distance. So you have to live within four townships or cities or combinations. So it's not like you can go to Arizona and live and still claim it. However, we do have where you can have son, daughter, and I can't remember. We haven't added grandson, I think. I think it's just son and daughter to this by marriage or by blood. So I think the whole idea here is, to what degree do you want to give a homestead benefits to somebody who really is not doing much of the actively farming? And maybe the decision that's been made in the past is too restrictive, but the decision up to this point has been that strictly deciding on management of planting 100 acres of corn and 100 acres of barley probably wouldn't qualify, because that isn't enough of a management. You need to do some, I mean, you have to be participating in some of the, I don't know if day-to-day is what I wouldn't quite go to that extreme, but I would say that the person really has to be more actively involved than that, because that isn't an actively involved person by, you know, what all the committee. There's been a lot of discussion through this, and maybe we need to look at whether or not that's too tight. But I think this opened up the benefits to other people who really aren't on the farm anymore. And, you know, the legislature needs to decide if, in fact, they want to make them even more generous. And this has been a real, real issue over the last years. And as you open it up more and more, pretty soon everybody will be receiving homestead, because we've also expanded it to all sorts of trusts and corporations and partnerships and, you know, I mean, a lot of the changes that Mr. Streeter was talking about, I mean, a lot of that language is to make everything uniform, and so we've also expanded it for that. So I think maybe the issue is whether or not, you know, the legislature wants to look at that and redefine, or maybe define in statute, what they mean by actively farming. So
we want to beat this up a little bit more, Representative Mallory.
Does that help at all?
Mr. Chairman, I was going to say what she slipped in there at one point. This is getting awfully broad to qualify in this. Pretty soon I'm going to be considered a farmer someplace. The way we're going, and I think this is
hands free.
We're not going to get that broad. Yeah.
What she described, I mean, having spent a lot of time on a farm growing up, I do know that this is getting really far afield from, I think, the original intent, and I just wonder if that shouldn't be looked at, and this language tightened up an awful lot.
Well, members, something certainly open for discussion. We can send it to the Representative Van Veer's division. You can go find out how far four townships is away from the farm.
Well, we couldn't do it without Representative Zellers.
As I said, sounds to me like, as I said, this is something that Representative Schwigham slipped into a piece of legislation somewhere. So, anyway, let's, as I said, if there are no further questions on this particular, on Section 22 and Section 23, let's continue.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make one more small comment about Section 23, and somebody mentioned whether there was a definition of actively farming, and there isn't one in the current statute, and our proposed changes wouldn't add a definition of actively farming. We were only trying to, you know, reach the narrow question of how much of the land that is being actively farmed needs to be farmed in order to qualify for the classification. If this committee desires, we could certainly go into and try to get more of an exposition of what actively farming means, but it was not the original intent in proposing this to try to define actively farming. Section 25, then, going on, amends the statute to provide that when an applicant for a blind or disabled homestead, that status must be now established by July 1st of the assessment year in order to be eligible for the classification. The reason for this is the prior statute had some income requirements, and the status was determined when those income requirements were met. Now there are no income requirements, and there did need to be a date, after which to determine the classification. We chose July 1st. That's the date that's also used for determining exemption status. Another alternative would have been January 2nd, and I understand that the counties are okay with the July 1st date for determining this this status.
Section 26 was mentioned earlier. Section 27 has to do with property tax appeals involving utility or railroad property. Again, there's a lot of underlined language in Section 27, but it deals with a provision that was first enacted in 2001, I think it was, amended in 2003, and now we're trying to rewrite it again just to make it clear. It's kind of a complicated, not quite as complicated as actively farming, but it's kind of a complicated situation where the commissioner provides values for a utility or railroad properties either by order or by recommendation, and if it's by order, the taxpayer can either appeal the order or the property tax that results from implementation of the order. But in any event, what we're trying to do here is if, for example, you're a railroad company with property in 27 different counties, and it's the commissioner who valued that property to begin with, that you should be able to sue the commissioner over your value rather than having to go to each of the 27 counties, which might put them at a disadvantage and also you as a taxpayer. And again, there's a lot of underlying language here, but all we're trying to do is clarify the original concept, which is if the commissioner valued you your property, you should be suing the commissioner, not the county. And not only should you sue the commissioner, but we want you to sue the commissioner. That's easier for the counties, easier for you, and we're just trying to get the language right on this. A question has come up on it. I'm not sure if the person who talked to me in the hallway has got the latest version of the bill, but you might see some further refinement of this language. We'll see how that works out.
I think we're going to take stop right here since we've got several more sections in property taxes that we aren't going to be able to get to today. Members, please put all the materials back in your packet. Tomorrow morning we will continue the discussion on the on House File 657, the Department of Revenue's technical and policy changes. Hey, Representative Lanchesky, would you be willing to move the minutes from the February 2nd meeting? Are there any changes, additions, deletions to the minutes? If not, all those in favor of the minutes as written, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, minutes are approved. Meeting's adjourned.